I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate. Hugh Pope moved to Damascus in 1979 with nothing but a degree in Arabic and Persian and an ambition to report on the real Middle East. 30 years and half a dozen countries later, at least half a dozen, he still hasn't left the Middle East. The former writer for the UPI, AP, and the Wall Street Journal shares his experience with us, and his new book is called Dining with Al-Qaeda, 3 decades Exploring the Many Worlds of the Middle East. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. Hugh Pope is with us today. Thanks for coming in.
Hello.
So how did you settle on the curlicue script of Arabic as your source of study and torment?
Because I wanted to do something different.
Yeah, that's it.
I could have been one of the 400 people in my university studying English literature, but I actually wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to have something new to say, and I knew that I would be a mediocre student of English literature, not being that great on Anglo-Saxon and stuff. So I thought, well, why not do Arabic?
And how'd the Middle East become a form of fascination?
I think it's something addictive about it. I was brought up in, I was born in South Africa, and I spent a lot of time, my father was an archaeologist, classicist, and so I spent quite a bit of time in the Eastern Mediterranean, and something about the warmth of the atmosphere, especially on a day like this in New York, I certainly feel that, and the warmth of the people make me feel more at home there than where I was actually educated, which was Britain, which is a fairly reserved country, as you well know.
And so it wasn't the case with some globe-trotting reporters who desperately want to do it to get out of their provincial world that they grew up in. You were already a person of the world. You traveled before you even became a reporter. You were in many different countries, and I suppose your family encouraged being adventuresome.
Yes, and I think yes, I was already traveling a lot, and I found that that was the most congenial place for me. But I started in the Arab and Persian world. I lived in Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, and Iran, but I eventually settled on actually Turkey to live in for most of the time. The last 23 years I've lived in Turkey because I find that mixes both the Middle East and Europe. And so I like to have a bit of both.
And you went into becoming a reporter a generation or two removed from the era of colonialism. You had absorbed Edward Said's lessons on Orientalism. You knew you didn't want to caricature the Middle East. But still, what happened when those aspirations met reality?
Well, my image of the Middle East was all medieval poetry, caravans in the desert, oases with ashes from old campfires. And I got to the Middle East and discovered it was ugly concrete buildings, traumatized societies, and wars. And it took me quite a long time to get my head around that, especially since these are very untransparent countries, very difficult to learn how they really work. And by the time I'd learned how they worked, and I was a working reporter, I suddenly realized that I was unable to completely explain that to a Western audience, and especially an American audience. And when I joined the Wall Street Journal about 13 years ago and was 10 years with them, when it came to the Middle East, there was something special. It's always difficult to explain a third world country or developing country to a developed country. But there were some special things about the Middle East that made it especially difficult to get the full story across to Americans. And eventually that proved very frustrating to me.
So what were some of the barriers or barriers you didn't even know would be in place?
Well, there's some generic ones, which I think you could say that there's a conceptual gap between the US and the Middle East, and that is the huge gap in prosperity, the lack of transparency, and the sense that, for instance, Americans feel a sense of individual empowerment, whereas in the Middle East, everything is done by tribes which look after you and you look after them. There's also the fact that it's generically unstable. There have been 15 wars and revolutions that have swept through the Middle East in the past century. America's fought 2 wars, but not on its own territory. And so it's very stable, and it's much more easy to consider long-term planning, for instance. I mean, in most Middle Eastern countries, an individual will not make a plan longer than a few weeks, really. I know there are political gaps that are obviously particular to the Middle East, which are the lobbyists, the U.S. perception of Israel as a completely unquestionable ally. There's prejudices against Muslims, prejudices against Arabs. Those are also very difficult to overcome as a reporter.
But it seems like, from reading your book and talking to you, you went into the Middle East as someone who wanted to cover a political system, but a culture and a kind of people, whereas a lot of reporters go there because they want to be war correspondents. You were covering a place that was often racked with war. A lot of people are war correspondents. What's the difference in the kind of reporting you bring back?
Well, I think that as a young a young person in my early 20s, there's one thing about wars is that everyone wants to hear about them. And so it's a great way to get a start in the profession. And I did that too. And I was completely unaware of the dangers that I was running in driving into artillery fire or just going to where a battle was going on without really thinking about the consequences. As time went on and as my friends began to, well, there were obviously several people I know who've been killed, you become very cautious. And I think I survived by running away. But some people are running away from themselves when they become war correspondents, and they become very high on the adrenaline rush of being close to battle. And as I described in Dining with Al-Qaeda, there were times when I would, like the Iraq war, I was so much against that war that I refused to go to the front lines. And people would almost come back to dinner after spending a day in the fighting, and I would feel very alienated from the whole process.
Right. See, when you wrote about that, I thought of the you can't serve on a jury where the death penalty is at stake if you come out and say, I'm just against the death penalty. You disqualify yourself. I was thinking that's the analogy. The war reporter, so against the war, disqualifies himself from coverage. So maybe that skews the kind of coverage that we got.
I don't think one has to be bloodthirsty to cover what's going on in a country. I used to view it as not covering a war, but covering the situation. And I certainly had to earn my living. And so I had, when the Iraq war happened, even though I'd spent the whole year beforehand trying to explain to readers of the Wall Street Journal why it would be madness to go into Iraq, I didn't want to be involved. I mean, I suppose I could have gone to Baghdad, but I didn't. Yeah. I didn't want to be there. And yes, I had a political position, and it was a very strange feeling, because I think when you oppose a very strong political force, like the pro-war sentiment in the US at that time was very strong, it's like standing up against a gale force wind. I felt at turns emasculated, impotent, and at points physically sick, that this war was going to happen. It was completely unnecessary. It was going to have completely bad consequences. And that's why most people in the Middle East didn't think it was going to happen. Everyone knew it was mad to invade Iraq. Why would America do that? It must be a brilliant bluff.
Yeah, especially because we find out later that Saddam Hussein's whole policy of claiming he has nuclear weapons is a brilliant bluff. Why couldn't that go on?
Yeah, he knew he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, so he assumed that the American intelligence services knew that too.
So you're a reporter. You're against it, but your reporting is going in the paper. What does that tell you about what people say about the power of the media? I mean, possibly most of the reporters that you talk to who were covering this knew that it would be some level of madness. Is the power of the media overstated therefore?
I felt that I had no impact on the national conversation in the United States as someone who was... My opinion of objectivity is to be fair while you're reporting something. I didn't take a position of being against war, but I did have a message about what the consequences of that would be.
Right.
And if
you go back and look at your reporting, you nailed it, right? I mean,
well, in this case,
it stands up.
Not everyone can be always right, but in this case, it was obvious to someone who was in the field.
Right.
On the question of how much impact you have, it's not great. And, most of the reporters that I was with in northern Iraq were swept away with the grandness of the gesture. Saddam Hussein is bad, therefore getting rid of him is good. And it seemed to make sense to people that didn't come from the Middle East. But all of us knew that when you take away a governing system in a Middle Eastern country, you have chaos. And that is obviously what we're dealing with now. It's Iraq is gradually rebuilding itself. We don't know how long that will take, but... Yeah, so after the Iraq war, I left journalism. I didn't feel that it made sense for me to do that anymore.
Do you think that being in Lebanon, a chaotic place without central governing, and Somalia, where they had no government but they had chaos, did that inform and give you some knowledge about what would happen once they removed Saddam Hussein, those specific experiences?
My experience was more of Afghanistan before it was in the 1990s, and yes, for most Middle Easterners, any kind of order is better than disorder, because that means less people are getting killed. And getting killed is much worse than being merely oppressed, in most people's opinion. So that's how I saw it anyway.
Another reporter, I'm not sure of his timeline, Chris Hedges of the New York Times, and he left daily reporting and wrote a book called, I think, I might get the title wrong, War is the Force That Gives Us Meaning. And he provided the epigraph for the movie The Hurt Locker. I guess he came to a little bit of a different conclusion. Well, I don't know, maybe just the timing was different. But to take all his war reporting and to kind of think about, or all his Middle East reporting, to think about what war means. I mean, are you familiar with his
work?
Absolutely.
It was a very good book.
Yeah. And what do you think about war being the force that gives us meaning?
Well, I've now worked for an NGO that basically aims to promote peace processes and avoid conflicts called the International Crisis Group. And that's my answer to the question. I think that it's possible to lower conflicts, prevent wars, and we do it through informing all the sides to a conflict of their real positions, which are usually they don't want to go and fight. Fighting is a last resort. And I think that it's possible to use writing, journalism, information to prevent wars, as well as what Chris Hedges was more talking about, his personal engagement with the process and the way he became addicted to it, which is something which you do see with war reporters.
Yeah. So you worked in Afghanistan. Which countries? You want to give us a quick order of the countries that you were in, that you're based in?
There's 30 of them. I think I'll
where were your main postings?
I started in Syria. I was in Egypt, in Lebanon, and Bahrain, in the Persian Gulf, in Iran, in Cyprus, in Sudan, and then Turkey. And then from Turkey, I covered a lot of the Caucasus and Central Asia and the Balkans, and then went back to the Middle East. I also lived in Tehran for a year. And so I've been around the block there and learned the languages. And I feel that that gives someone like me, who's really seen the cycles come and go, a feeling for it that I wasn't able to get through in my daily reporting, and that's why I wrote this book.
And the book definitely has some revelations that a newspaper reporter would not be, would be dissuaded from offering in a daily paper. For instance, you're very critical of Robert Fisk, who I knew as the reporter for The Guardian, but he's written for a lot of different English newspapers, and he exaggerates a lot. How common is that, or is that particular to Fisk?
I tried to describe everything in the book as only what I have seen with my own eyes. I try and avoid any generalization or theorizing. And the reason I focus in a few pages on Robert Fisk's journalism is that he inspired me to go to the Middle East. His writing is of a level of genius, and it's so compelling that it makes you feel like you're actually there and you understand everything that's happening. And when I started working beside him, as I explain in the book, I saw that there was a sensationalism involved. I didn't pay much attention to it until, as a result of one article that he wrote, I was expelled from Turkey. I managed to get the order rescinded. But again, I still felt that what he was doing was more important, because he could communicate at an emotional level the cruelty of Western policies in the region, and also what was happening to the Palestinians, and in a way that none of us more careful journalists could do so.
Well, what was the force? The force was in his exaggeration and his lack of adherence to strictly the facts.
In the case that I was quite shocked to discover that he had overstated the extent of what he saw as a confrontation between Turkish soldiers and Kurds and British soldiers. And in the process of writing this article, he had put in things which were simply not true. And because I was expelled as a result of that story, I went and looked at it very closely. And yes, in this case, unfortunately, it's a sad fact that not everyone can be right all of the time. And unfortunately, I think most people, when they read newspapers, especially in the United States, especially the mainstream newspapers, there's an assumption that there's almost a biblical quality to the texts. It's not like that. Every news journalism is as close as anyone can get. And most journalists that I've worked with in the Middle East have been as thorough as they can be. And I think that the problem is when people take what other people write as being gospel truth, and that cannot be the case.
It is interesting that you gave this close reading to this article by Robert Fisk, because I don't know if you're aware, but on the internet there is a verb to Fisk something, which it means to give something an extremely close reading, because this was done by other Robert Fisk articles. Anyway, just might be coincidence. I'm speaking with scholar and former Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Hugh Pope about his book Dining with Al-Qaeda, 3 decades Exploring the Many Worlds of the Middle East. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books, and we'll have more after a break. Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Hugh Pope, author of Dining with Al-Qaeda, 3 decades Exploring the Many Worlds of the Middle East. Israel, you reported from Israel, in Israel. A lot of reporters don't want the assignment. It's a headache. You have to deal with a very engaged and vocal American public. Most of your work is scrutinized like no other posting in the world. So why do you want to take the job?
I had no choice. It was 2000. My foreign editor offered me, I was already covering about 10 countries based in Turkey. He said, Hugh, do you want to do Iran? I said, sure. Persian Gulf. Yeah. North Africa. Okay. And then he said, well, and also the Arab-Israeli thing. It was 30 countries, all of them, almost all of them very difficult and inaccessible. That says what America was thinking about the Middle East back in 2000. It's not relevant. The oil price has gone down to nothing. The peace process, as we used to call it, you know, has disappeared. And the Oslo process then was going out. And so basically, American media had written the Middle East off. And so they handed it to me. And so I accepted it as part of this broad palette, the broader Middle East.
So being in the Arab world, the Muslim world, that whole time, you write, you're pretty honest that you had certain, I think the word you used was biases or at least opinions about Israel. What were those and what did you have to do to rethink them?
I'd started out in Syria and Lebanon. Now, in Syria, I spent a lot of time in Palestinian refugee camps. And that was a pretty gruesome place to do reporting back in the 80s. They were very impoverished and very bitter, and they had horrible stories. And, of course, you tend to take on the color of your environment. So they were extremely radical against Israelis, and I wasn't that bad, but I could sympathize with them. Then I went to Lebanon, where at the time more than half of it was occupied by the Israeli army. I was shot at by Israelis. I was insulted by Israelis. So that also creates a certain attitude. But at a certain point, they opened the border, the Israeli-Lebanese border. And I thought, right, now I've got to go and have a look for myself because I can't be like this all the time. So I went and visited Israel in 1983 for my first trip, a kind of pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so that's when I started changing my mind, because at that point, I hadn't realized how much of a Middle Eastern state and the Arab side of Israel had, and I was fascinated because I was quite radical as a young man. I almost immediately, when I arrived at the border, had a tremendous sense of shock at when I came out of this war-shattered country of Lebanon, walked up a dirt track and got to the actual Israeli border. And there was a beautifully pointed stone viewing platform with lots of tourists in shorts looking at us with binoculars. And I felt that was such an awful contrast that I took a vow that I would only speak Arabic during my time in Israel. And you'd have thought that that would exclude me from a civilized company while in Israel. But actually, I discovered that a lot of older Israelis from the Muslim world spoke quite good Arabic. And so if I went to an older guy who looked a bit Middle Eastern, even if he was a Jewish Israeli, I would have a conversation with him in Arabic. And that was quite an eye-opener to me, as it was indeed to an Egyptian playwright who visited Israel on a pilgrimage. Rather similar idea to me, I think. He wanted to get to know these people that were supposed to be his enemy. And he went there and he discovered what he thought was the reason that Israel had such bad relations with its Arab neighbors was that actually only an Arab could hate other Arabs as much as that. And so the Israelis' Arab side was what the problem, of all the frictions was.
Did you stick to your vow of Arabic only?
No. I talked my way through the Muslim gate onto the dome of the rock. And by absolute coincidence, I walked into the arms of my Arabic tutor from Oxford. And at that point, I felt that I, even though I wasn't a really good student, I could say, look what I can do now. And
yeah.
He gave me a break from my Arabic-only vow.
Did you ever learn Hebrew or try to? Do you need to cover it?
Of course, yeah. I think if you were covering Israel properly, yes. Yeah. I think you do need to know the languages of a place. And what's interesting is how much Hebrew shares with Arabic. Of course, it's also a Semitic language, and some of the letters look similar, the numbers are the same. And so it's very familiar for someone from the Arab world to go to. So it's much closer than most people realize.
Right, and that's why Yasser Arafat would think he was clever by saying, how could you call me anti-Semitic? The Palestinians are Semitic. And you met Yasser Arafat when you were very young in Syria, right? Or in Lebanon.
Yes. He came just after the massacres in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon. I happened to be there, and I met him and took pictures of him. But later was perhaps slightly interesting moment when you consider that S. Arafat was kicked out of Beirut by an Israeli invasion. I didn't cover that from Beirut, but I did. A year later, he was kicked out of another city in Lebanon, Tripoli, by the Syrians. And I did cover that. And it seemed very symbolic of the problems the Palestinians face. They're damned if they do, damned if they don't.
Did you come to think of Yasser Arafat himself as a problem the Palestinians faced?
Yeah, he's a... later in his life, his administration was notoriously corrupt, but his prestige and charisma was such that he was unassailable. And so in a way, as every big man of the East, they become a problem, but at the same time, they're what's holding everything together. So they are both the problem and the solution. And the way forward, of course, is a more pluralistic society, which is only possible after years of development and stability. And unfortunately, that stability has not yet been granted to the Middle East.
So as you speak about covering Israel, I think of a couple things that Tom Friedman says. First of all, he always says you have to read Arafat's speech or whoever's speech in Arabic. It has a lot of different meanings than the English translation. But he says when covering Israel, people want to own you. And if they can't own you, they want to destroy you. So maybe you were shielded from it and your editors didn't let all the angry letters get through. But was it somewhat of a nightmare to deal with the public that you were writing for when you were covering Israel?
My editors did protect me. I worked for the Journal, and they were an extraordinarily good newspaper to work for, very honest on the news pages. And they would only make me respond to intelligent and clearly honestly written letters. The sort of machine mail things were diverted into another place. I think most people don't realize how much newspapers pay attention to real readers' letters, because most people don't write. They just throw up their hands and say, you can't believe what you read in the press. But actually, as reporters for the Journal, we had to answer or supply the information to answer any real objection. And the fact is that on the Israeli question, a lot of people did write in, and the effect was to deter one from being too daring. You would always err on the side of caution. I mean, even if one said Palestinian refugees in the Middle East, you'd have people writing and saying, no, that is the refugees and the descendants of refugees. They're not all refugees. And anyway, they fled. They weren't forced out.
Yeah.
So you would always be forced to remove some of the truth. And although 80% of what we wrote was right, we would admit things. And I think over the years, over the decades, all those little omissions in our coverage, thanks to the pressure of lobbies, thanks also to the American cultural preconceptions about the Middle East and also what they want to read about the Middle East. But those little distortions added up to a big wall of incomprehension between America and the Middle East, which is why we have stumbling into the war with Iraq, I think.
And we're not saying it here, but you know, I read in your book, you would do stories on how the Syrians purposefully left the refugee camps in a miserable state for their own purposes and for the PR purposes. So you would write about all of that as well.
Absolutely. Yes. No, there are no saints in the Middle East.
Yeah.
But I think the main problem, the way that America currently looks at the Middle East, has been looking up at the Middle East until very recently. There are extraordinary changes that I see at the moment. But typically, they see it as sort of bad versus good, radicals versus moderates, and they don't let any of the nuances come in. But in fact, there are plenty of nuances, and that's what needs to come through.
A person listening to this who maybe considers himself a large supporter of Israel might hear this and say, the Wall Street Journal's man in Jerusalem, was that where you lived?
I lived in Istanbul.
Istanbul,
occasionally. Yeah.
But who is responsible for covering Israel, has just admitted he was biased against Israel when he came in, and he's trying to explain how that was okay. Or maybe I haven't given you the opportunity to explain, but I'll put that to you. Why is it okay to be biased against a country, even if you're biased and trying to work against that and covering it?
I think there's a difference between bias and sympathy.
Yeah.
And I feel that, of course, having lived in the Arab world, I was sympathetic to their point of view. But that when I went to Israel, I made a great effort to be fair in my coverage of it. And what I did as a Wall Street Journal reporter was that I said, trying to get a story about Israel onto the front page of the Wall Street Journal was like getting into a high security prison, because they weren't interested. They did not want to know. But what I did, I challenged myself. I said, right, I'm going to go and stay in a West Bank settlement and get to know these people and find out what it is that makes them West Bank settlers. I was amazed. You know, highly sophisticated people from 20 different countries, extremely interesting to be with, but very, very unable to understand that the land they just built their very pleasant gated community on was viewed by the impoverished Arab village next door as being their land and that had been stolen from them. And their view was that God gave us this place, but the Arab view was, well, we've been living here for thousands of years. What do you mean God gave that to you? And it made me realize, and you know, I was spending 24 hours with a rabbi, and I then became sympathetic to them personally. And the problem was, unfortunately, is when it came to the actual newspaper story, is that the the typical standards of approach meant that even though I, as someone sympathetic to the Palestinian side, when the story came out, it made it look like the problem was the Palestinians, that there had been a long period of peace between Israelis and Palestinians, and then a Palestinian gunman had disturbed the peace and made it all bad. And that was shocking to me, that I had somehow become part of the "it can all get better, this is a problem that we can all sit down and discuss." Whereas, in fact, it's much, you know, a West Bank settlement is a much, much graver problem. And I think it's also what Mr. President Obama is beginning to address.
That's another bias that people don't talk about with maybe Western reporting, that this can be worked out among reasonable people.
Yes, I think that people don't realize the extent to which, if you are in these Middle Eastern societies that have been so traumatized, it's going to take a long time for everyone to become normal again. And that's something that everyone needs to give the region time and stability to work things through.
I want to ask you about another recent journalistic question that's been raised. Ethan Bonner, who covers Jerusalem, he is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. His son's in the Israeli army. The Times editor says, "We disclose that, our readers know about that, and we don't want to take Ethan Bonner off the job since he's a good journalist." But the public editor, who is no position of authority except to give his opinion, says he thinks it's wrong, at least for perception's sake. What do you think?
I think it would depend on the circumstances. I think Ethan Bonner is a responsible journalist. He's got a long track record with the New York Times. Why would you single out the fact that his son is in the IDF? If he's obviously an Israeli citizen, then you have to serve in the IDF. And I don't know the circumstances exactly, but I wouldn't say that was a reason to say he cannot write for the New York Times. I think that's a personal matter. But because I live in Turkey, for instance, and a lot of people wouldn't even visit me in Turkey because of the human rights violations in Turkey. So they viewed me as, just by the fact I lived in Turkey, I'd taken a position. And I think that's really unfair. I think that I think the more bridges there are between the two sides, the better.
So many stories, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your dinner with Al-Qaeda. What happened?
Well, it was just after September the 11th, and we were very interested in, obviously, the pilots of these planes, Mohammed Atta and the others, and I'd been on their trail a bit, but I happened to have a visa for Saudi Arabia, and I wanted to find out about the 15 Saudis who were on those planes. No one ever really talked about them, and why did those kids go on? And they seemed more or less cannon fodder, and I had a contact in the radical Islamic side of Saudi Arabia, and I asked him if he could fix me up with a meeting with Al-Qaeda, and he did. And I went there, and it was the most extraordinary occasion. This young 23-year-old came in, very thin, with a wispy beard, and he sat down, and he announced that he would like to kill me. And I protested that this was not necessarily what we needed to do.
Argued him off that point. Very yeah. Good.
And then once he'd been convinced that I was on the level, he decided he wanted to tell me about these 15 kids. And he'd been in the camps with them in Afghanistan. And he obviously thought they were wonderful and said they were wonderful boys and how very deeply pious they were and how noble they were. And I mean, I beg to disagree. I think that what they did was awful. But the fact was that it was very difficult to get angry with this young Al-Qaeda missionary, because he was a bit flaky. I mean, we went out for a Chinese meal together even, and it was very funny. He pulled a trick on me, which you don't often see anymore, where the question came of who's going to pay, he pulled out a crumpled equivalent of a $1,000 note in Saudi Arabia, and then I had to pull out my Amex card and pay myself for my dinner with Al-Qaeda. Yeah.
And finally, I said, do you know if he's been arrested, that particular guy? Do you know if anything happened to him?
He had been arrested several times before my meeting with him, and I have no idea what happened afterwards. But because he didn't give he didn't give me his name, yeah. And I had no means of standing up his story, even though after 8 hours I was convinced he was telling me the truth, despite the fact that I was the first person to get anywhere close to these 15 Saudi members of the the four planes that were in action that day. I never got the story into the newspaper.
Dining with Al-Qaeda is the name of the book. Hugh Pope has written it. It describes his three decades exploring the many worlds of the Middle East. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
And this is Mike Pesca. Tomorrow, Jonathan Capehart will be speaking with, this is WNYC and WNYC.org. On tomorrow's show, guest host Jonathan Capehart sits in for Leonard. He'll talk with Bill Ayers and Lynn Pentecost about the hunger crisis in America and what's being called the hunger obesity paradox. Then Dan Strebel, director of the Orphan Film Symposium, discusses what's in store for the 2010 biennial. Also, Project Runway's Tim Gunn and actress Raquel Welch. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Carrie Barber, Adam Delahanty, and Andrea Maraskin. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening, and please come back tomorrow.